is where something doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But it is absolutely different from being modest. A bougie person may be immodest in the sense that if he knows he can do something well, he just says he can. He doesn't go at all sorts of blushing violet techniques. Bougie, you see, is this mysterious quality of nothing special, no special method. Because if there is, let me repeat, if we do know the method and we know it infallibly, it ceases to be interesting. There are no surprises left. And the moment the element of surprise has gone, the zest of life has gone. That, you see, is why it's very difficult to teach Zen to yourself. Because you can't easily surprise yourself. The essence, you see, of this kind of spontaneity is response to a surprise. So the master, you don't know what he's going to do, and he surprises you. It's like trying to cure hiccups. Very difficult to cure yourself, because when you pat yourself on the back, you know when you're going to do it. So you're all ready for it. When somebody else comes up and slams you on the back, then that's a surprise, and what you needed was a surprise. Or it's like jokes. What makes you laugh about a joke is the element of surprise in it. That's why jokes aren't funny after they've been explained. So in the same way, all these Zen stories, if explained, have no effect. They're intended to produce what I would call metaphysical laughter. But this has to be a surprise. And so as to be surprised, well, there's no way of premeditating it. So you see, if you read, for example, there's a book out here called Zen by Eugen Herigel, who studied archery. Many of you have probably read this book. He had to learn to pull the bowstring in the manner of the Japanese archer and let it go, but not on purpose. He had to let it go without thinking first, I'll let it go, and then let go. He had to let it go, not on purpose. Now, that really bugged Herigel. How do you do something not on purpose? Especially if you're aiming at a target. Well, the whole point is, if you think before you shoot, it's too late. The target's moved. That's why we have a thing like beginner's luck. You see, if you simply point at something like that, if your finger was a gun, I would probably have hit the light switch. And so you get a person who's naive about a gun, will pick a gun up and bang, and the thing will drop dead. I'll never forget the first time I ever used a slingshot. This friend of mine was with me and he was aiming away and not missing, and I just picked it up, ping, and it hit. But I couldn't do it again. You get a certain naturalness there. So there was a master by the name of Ikkyu, who was a great leg puller. And he had in front of his house a very gnarled pine tree. One of those things that's contorted, and they love this kind of thing. And he put a notice up by it. Said, I, Ikkyu, will pay 100 yen, which was a fair amount of money in those days, to anyone who can see this tree straight. Well, soon, there was a whole crowd of people around that tree, lying on the ground and twisting their necks and looking at it from all sorts of angles. And there was absolutely no way of seeing the tree with a straight trunk. But Ikkyu had a friend who was a priest of another sect, and a smart boy went over to see this friend and said, what about this Mr. Ikkyu's tree? Oh, said the other priest, it's perfectly simple. He said, you go and tell him the answer to seeing the tree straight is to look straight at it. So this man went over to Ikkyu and said, I claim the reward. He said, you look straight at it. And Ikkyu looked him in a funny way and said, He was forked out the 100 yen and gave it to him. He said, I think you've been talking to Rosen down the street. Now, in that way, you see, just look straight at it. In other words, here's the bowstring, let go of it. All this fimble-fambling, mimble-mambling, jumble-humble about the right technique of letting go of it. Let go of it, damn it! But that's very difficult. It's as if I would say to you, now, everybody, let's be unselfconscious. And so finally, in desperation, you at last learn to let go of the thing, which was what you were supposed to do all the time. And then one is as again as a child. This is original innocence. So this is the meaning of the person who was asked, what do you do here in this Zen institution? He said, we eat when hungry and we sleep when tired. Well, he said, that's being just like everybody else. They all do that. He said, they do not. When they eat, they don't eat. But they think of all sorts of extraneous matters. When they're tired, they don't sleep. They dream all kinds of dreams. Nobody ever transforms himself into an enlightened pattern of life by dividing himself in two pieces. Good I and bad me, wherein good I preaches to bad me and tries to make me over. As if a human being were divided, were like a rider on a horse, and the rider is the soul and the horse is the body, or the rider is reason and the horse is passion, the rider is control and the horse is the uncontrolled. In other words, we've got the opposition of the ego allied with the superego, trying to ride the ego aligned with the id. And Freud's metaphors and Freud's construction of the sort of psychic anatomy of mankind is really derived from Plato, with the image of the soul riding the animal horse. Now, all this is a total failure, because there is a secret connection, as it were a sort of backstairs, between good I and bad me. Good I can look down at bad me and say, you oughtn't to be like that. But all the time, bad me is sending its energy up the backstairs to good I and motivating good I to go, at bad me, but for the reasons of bad me. I ought to be better, because then I could be more proud of myself. So, in this way, there is something about spirituality, self-conscious spirituality, all kinds of religion involving preaching and moralizing and talking to oneself in a split and divided way, good I against bad me, that is profoundly phony. One of the main streams of Buddhist way of life to be what one might call the religion of non-religion. To find, to demonstrate, to convey what is the most highly spiritual through what is the most everyday and ordinary, and to make no division between the two. So that you might say the more everyday it is, the more truly spiritual it is. But the more it appears to be spiritual, that is to say, something different from, aside from, apart from everyday life, the more false that kind of spirituality will be. And this reaches a peak in the history of Japanese culture in the 17th century, when in this country there were four superbly important men. Basho, the haiku poet. Bankei, a Zen teacher, Hakuin, another Zen teacher, and Sengai, a Zen painter. And I want to say something about the work of these four men and their genius and the movement in Japanese history which they represented, which you might call the democratization of the esoteric. And there's something about this of extraordinary interest to Americans. Because for good, for better or for worse, we as Americans live in a culture in which there is nothing esoteric. There are no secrets, except those things which cannot be understood. In a way, they are always esoteric. Only a few people can understand them. And they don't need to be guarded, because even if you, for example, you publish a textbook on nuclear physics, and only very few people can understand it. But in the sense that it is published, it is no longer esoteric. In our world, for example, a teacher tries his utmost to make himself understood. He knocks himself out to make his message assimilable without tears. But as I've explained to you, in Oriental cultures, teachers expect the student to make the effort to attain the understanding. So a teacher is difficult, and you must put yourself out to understand what he says. He's not going to make it easy for you, because of the feeling that what comes to you too easily doesn't really come to you. Now, however, there was in 17th century Japan a movement among the people you might call esoteric to make their understanding available to the masses. In a sense, arising out of Buddhist compassion, the idea that the aim in life of a bodhisattva is to bring enlightenment to as many other sentient beings as possible. And always the problem is, you see, when you've popularized something, how to do it without making it vulgar, cheap, watered down, insipid. And these four men were in their own quite different ways geniuses at doing it. Let's start with Basho. Basho didn't invent haiku poetry, but he brought it to a certain degree of development whereby it was possible for ordinary people who were not very literate to become poets. Now, you to understand the situation in which Basho arose, you must realize that Japanese poetry grows on the tree of Chinese tradition, and that by the 17th century, Chinese poetry was as difficult to follow as, say, T.S. Eliot is today. Now, to understand T.S. Eliot's poems, The Four Quartets, you have to know an enormous amount of world literature and some very, very obscure books. Because T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets is a complex texture of allusions to other works. And you have to know what these other works are in order to get the point. So this is poetry written strictly for literati. And the Chinese brought this to a high degree of perfection. So that, you see, poets were writing only for other poets. They weren't getting anything across to people who just, as it were, spoke everyday language. This happened also in Japan. If you read, say, a novel like The Tale of Genji, and read all about the light-footed amours of those very, very cultivated people, and with their little poems and things, the subtle kinds of illusion they had. And also, when tea ceremony became over-refined, you know, there were suggestions in the shade of a cup which was intended to remind you of something. You know, a complicated set of associations which the master planned, and you were supposed to get the point. And so people indulged in all kinds of fantastic one-upmanship in seeing who did or didn't recognize the subtle chains of association, recognition of which depended upon a great deal of learning. Well, you see what that is? That's a very elaborate game. And the intent and the object of the game is not really delight, but seeing who can out-associate whom. So these 17th century masters rebelled against all that kind of thing. And they wanted tea and poetry and painting and Zen to be appreciated for itself and to be appreciated by anybody with human equipment. So Basho said, in order to write haiku, you should be taught by a child 3 feet high. Because a statement which such a child would make would be a poem. And a profound poem, to the degree, and especially to the degree, that what the child said was a simple image and had in it no kind of philosophizing, but was just that vivid statement which children do. You light the fire, and then I'll show you something wonderful, a great ball of snow. That's a haiku poem. And all these poems, each one simply takes an image and says no more. A brushwood gate, and for a lock, this snail. Leaf fallen, flying back to the branch, butterfly. You see, there's something a little bit clever about those ones, and for that very reason, they are not the best kind of haiku. Better still is something like this. In the dense fog, what is being shouted between hill and boat? You see the image of a river estuary, and you can't see anything, but you know there's someone down there in the boat talking to someone up on the hill, and you can't hear the conversation. You can't quite put your finger on. The quality which in Japanese aesthetics is called yugen, made up of two Chinese characters, both of which mean the dark, the deep, and the mysterious. But yugen is not like a great abyss full of black clouds and lightning in which there might be a dragon. That's not yugen. Yugen is the subtly mysterious.
Sounds True presents Leave It Be, Session 9, Contemplative Ritual with Alan Watts.
Before we begin our celebration,